super intense. One day, he accidentally cracked my ribs. The checklist behind the Krav Maga first strike boils down to three basic elements. One, has someone violated your space? Two, is there a direct threat? And three, get them before they get you. Sounds reasonable, right? During the months that followed, I practiced all the time. I went into work and told the people in my office to put me in a bear hug to see if I could escape, to try to poke me in the eye to see if I could block it, and to throw punches at me to see if I could defend an attack. It became sort of like the Kato scenes in the Pink Panther movies. Someone would jump out of the closet at me at odd moments. I wanted to see if this shit really worked. After months of training, I was ready. I was almost looking for a confrontation to happen. One Friday morning, I was leaving my apartment in a suit and tie for an important business meeting. I never wore a suit and tie, but on this day, I had to. So I was. I was also holding two trays of fruit, one in each hand, that I got a fairway the night before to bring to the meeting. And I had a string bag over my shoulder. When I stepped onto the elevator, there were two maintenance guys in there. I'd lived in the building for 10 years and basically knew everybody who lived and worked there. I talked to these guys all the time about the Knicks or whatever. "What's up?" I said when I got on. The elevator stopped on the next floor below us, and into the elevator walked a guy in his late 20s. I'd never seen him before, but he had this party frat bro chief big guy look to him, and an attitude to match. It was December, but he was sweating like a faucet, and his hair was all messed up. His eyes had a sheen. I moved back and over to my right to give him some room. He turned and faced the doors immediately, standing right in the middle of the elevator. But when the elevator door closed, he started backing up until he was right on top of me. I mean, his back was pushing up on my fruit trays, and he kept maneuvering like an annoyed person who keeps turning their neck at the movie theater. "Can you at least give me some room, asshole?" he said. I wasn't even sure he was talking to me at first. "Excuse me?" I said. He turned, looked at me, and gave a "try and fuck with me" look with red, runny eyes. I said, "Give me some room, fucko," he said. I looked at Angel, one of the maintenance guys, and he slowly shook his head as if to say, "Man, don't let him talk to you like that." The elevator started heading down. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The elevator doors open. And the guy walked out. "Maybe it's your mother's fault," he said under his breath, but loud enough for me to hear, "the way she raised you." I was standing there on fire. I could feel the heat rising in my body. "What did you say?" I said. He flipped me off as he headed for the door. I couldn't take it anymore. "Get the fuck over here and say it to my face," I said. At another time in my life, I would have been a little surprised and might have had some butterflies, but I was $16,000 into my Krav Maga lessons. I was dying to know if all the training worked. But I was also holding the two trays of cantaloupe chunks and sliced bananas and wearing a suit. Next thing I know, we were nose to nose. His breath stunk of last night's vodka and who knows what. I went through my Krav Maga checklist. Is he in my space? Check. Do I feel threatened? Check. Does this guy realize I'm going to knee him so hard in the nuts that his nuts are about to be in his ears? I'd done it with my instructor 6,000 times. And then I was going to take my fruit trays and play them like cymbals on his head. He must have sensed something because he turned quickly and left in a huff. Before I could make a move, he was gone from the building. But it was like he was walking away thinking he had won. When I got to work after my breakfast meeting, I was still steaming and couldn't think straight. I kept replaying the scenario in my head. What should or could I have done differently? I was in the conference room and I told everyone the story I just told you. And they were all like, you wimp. You let him go. The Krav Maga, man. I was so mad. I got back in a cab and returned to my building looking for him. I don't even know why, because I had seen the guy leave, but I was so angry, I wasn't thinking straight. I filled out some paperwork with the doorman to let him know the incident occurred. This way, when I saw the kid again, I'd be on the record that we had an argument and he instigated it. Maybe he wouldn't be able to sue me if we have a future fight, I thought. Every single day after that, I waited in the lobby for an extra beat in hopes that I'd see him again. In fact, Gowdy decided to hold one class in the elevator to simulate what might happen if the situation repeated itself. I became a master of elevator combat, using leverage against the wall, my spacing, everything. I knew every inch of that elevator. A month goes by, then two, and there was no sign of this asshole. I wore Krav Maga sweatshirts around the building like a motorcycle gang member's wears colors. Maybe I could get the word out. Okay, now that sounds a little ridiculous, but I wanted a rematch. Still, there was no sight of him. I tried to time my morning elevator ride to sync with the time of the incident, but I never saw him, ever. I was starting to question if the guy even lived in the building. Then one day, 6 months later, I was going for a bike ride. I pushed the elevator button and there he was, alone in the elevator, at last. I was holding my bike instead of my fruit trays. I was in my slippery bike shoes. They're like wearing clogs on an ice skating rink. I was wearing my stretchy bike shorts and a stretchy bike shirt. I looked like a Frenchman in Texas, and I had my helmet on. Shit, I didn't train to fight in this outfit. But before I could say a word, he said, I've been hoping to run into you. I want to apologize for that last time we were on the elevator. I couldn't have been more of a dick. I was high and shit. Please forgive me. It was like I threw 16 grand out the window. But today's service reminded me about the importance of forgiveness. Maybe I should be thinking more about Lenny's circumstances and what makes him like that instead of being annoyed and pissed off by him. I mean, my default button is usually to flip right to annoyed. When I get pissed off at someone who cuts me off, Sarah always says, what if that person is headed to the hospital for an emergency? And what if they had a terrible day? She's always giving others the benefit of the doubt. It frees her from getting angry herself. You don't have to own it. That's their stuff, she likes to remind me. And she's right. With all that said, though, I'm still ready to kick Lenny's ass if I need to. Okay, fine. I still have a lot of work to do up here. Day 5. The retreat. If you realize that all things change, there is nothing you will try and hold on to. Lao Tzu, Tao Te Ching. Outside of my window, I scanned the parking lot. It was starting to fill up with non-monks. An old 1970 Pontiac chugged up the driveway. Two elderly folks got out. I kept watching until they disappeared into the church. It has only been 5 days here, but it was strange to see civilians. And then more cars came driving up the driveway. And then four older folks got out. The monks had what they called a retreat today, and it didn't exactly draw a tailgate crowd. The church was sold out. I wouldn't be surprised if there were scalpers outside of it saying, I got two in the third pew, two in the third pew. Luckily, I hustled over there early and was able to get my usual seat. But man, that place was packed. And as a result, the church smells of monk and incense were magnified. I mean, the odor of incense was everywhere. The monks burn it as both a religious ritual and a way to mask body odor, or rather, that's the original purpose of incense, I'm told. I sat there waiting for the services to start and inhaled a huge whiff of incense. As soon as it hit my nose, I got an olfactory flashback to a dance crew called Soul Brothers. And there I went again with my mind, taking the scenic route to nowhere. Anyway, I toured with them in the early 1990s when my record came out. The Soul Brothers were three guys from Los Angeles who danced for my label mate, Def Jeff. They had appeared on the TV show In Living Color and had insane street cred. When I kicked off a college tour, I asked Jeff if they could roll with me as my dancers to fire up the crowd. They were cool cats who loved to smoke weed. Let me put it this way. If there was such a thing as the Snoop Dogg Marijuana Olympics, these guys would win the gold medal. They knew what they were doing and burned a lot of incense to try to hide the smell. A few years after I retired from rapping, I didn't get signed for a second album. I got a call from the Soul Brothers. They were going to Washington, D.C. for the Million Man March and were going to swing through New York City on their way back to Cali. They needed a place to stay and asked if they could crash at my apartment for one night. Of course, I said. They showed up on a Monday right before I was heading to work, so I told them to make themselves at home. I think they took that literally, because when I got back from work, they had taken all of my family pictures off the wall and replaced them with photos of Bob Marley and Malcolm X. I could smell the incense they burned for a week. Today, the church was buzzing with anticipation. I pulled myself back from my Soul Brother reminiscences and focused on being present. There were people from all over the country for the one-day retreat. They all seemed to be searching for something we all want. Happiness, meaning, and spirituality. You could just feel it in the air. I tried to get comfortable in my seat. The festivities started off with a lecture by Sister Rebecca. She's one of three Newskeet nuns. The nuns live down the mountain. They're like sorority sisters to the monks. They attend all the services and share in virtually all of the retreats, events, and functions. The nuns came to Newskeet a few years after the monks did. Their story is similar. Originally, there were a half dozen or so in a convent in Indiana, and they went looking for something a little more extreme, like a monastery on a mountain. They heard about the Newskeet monks, so they came here and stayed. They've also gained some fame with the way they support themselves. They bake cheesecakes and sell them all over the world. At least that's what the word on the street or the mountain is. Sister Rebecca stood at the podium at the front of the church. She looks like Aunt B from the Andy Griffith Show. Like Aunt B, she has mad spunk. As soon as she started talking, I got drawn in. Her message resonated. Treat yourself gently. Don't talk angry to yourself. We're all searching for peace, she said. But peace is already within. We simply need to work on our spirit. She was explaining how we need to recognize emotions and feelings of fear. I immediately thought of Lenny. Damn him. Maybe he is my lesson. Maybe the monks planted him here as a distraction. But thankfully, Sister Rebecca reeled me back in with her words. And from there, I started connecting the dots. Sometimes we get lost emotionally. So that makes awareness and mindfulness like the GPS. If we're aware of how we're feeling, it helps us process emotion to make better decisions. It gives us direction. To me, awareness isn't the same thing as gut. Gut, instinct, and educated guesses can help guide us forward, but being aware will rein in the emotional side of decision-making if and only if we are accepting of our feelings. If we can work gut and awareness at the same time, magic can happen. And then at one point, I looked up and Brother Gregory was standing right in front of me. He handed me a basket of what looked like Wonder Bread. I smiled and sort of put my hand up, indicating a no thank you for the snack. I wasn't hungry. And besides, it was before noon, so I can only have fruit. Brother Gregory leaned down real close to my ear. It was blessed at last night's vigil, he said. I quickly grabbed one and popped it in. Tasted like Wonder Bread to me. I grew up on the stuff. I swallowed. At that point, I think I was supposed to reflect on Christ's sacrifice and look forward to his return. And I have to say, as far as sacrifices go, his was pretty epic. His entire life sounds like a sacrifice. It's rather ironic because it seems like today, most people try to avoid sacrifices. It was a great service this morning. Love the message, and the blessed bread spoke to me as a symbol of being welcome as I am. As we all left the church, we started to get bottlenecked at the entrance. 60 people or so standing in and around the church. It was like a receiving line after a wedding ceremony. Just as I squeezed outside, one of the guests came up and gave me a big-ass bear hug. He did it on Sneak Attack. And it was a hug like I'd just gotten back from war. They attracted some interesting people to the retreat, and this guy was par for the course. He was about 6'2", an African-American fellow, bubbly and seemingly high on life, but the guy was basically spooning me, standing up. There was no escape. "Brother Christopher, are you wearing new cologne?" he asked, taking a big whiff of my neck. "Oh, I'm so sorry. You have me mistaken. I'm not Brother Christopher. I'm just Jesse," I said. "And I'm not wearing any cologne. Just Jesse. Ah, the new monk." And then, that's when he kissed me. He leaned in and planted one right on my cheek. Sound effects and all. He didn't stop there. He whisked his lips around my face to the other cheek and kissed it again. But this was no European double cheek air kiss. Nope. This was the real deal double cheek kiss. He pulled me back from his kiss, or should I say, our kiss. No, I think his kiss is more accurate, and he was still holding onto my shoulders. My cheeks must have had wet stains on them, and that's when I explained I wasn't a monk, but he didn't seem to care. "Funky up here, isn't it, Just Jesse? The vibes, the air, the smells, Just Jesse. Walk with me, vibe with me, and smell with me," he said. How could I say no to that offer? We walked by my room and he stopped, and then he sniffed. "You smell that?" "What?" "Orange peels. I've never smelled that up here before. There's something brewing. Can't you just smell it?" What the fuck? Does this guy have super sensory smell? "We get some distinct smells up here if we allow ourselves to breathe, Just Jesse." Now I was thinking maybe you can get some unique super smelling powers from being around the dogs or something. We walked over to the dining room together. "Our time has ended, Just Jesse," he said as he found a seat next to one of the monks. Nice guy, but I wasn't wearing any cologne. Breakfast was silent again. It reminded me of car trips with my parents when I was young. "The first one to talk loses," Mom would declare. Every time I'd yell as loud as I could, "I lose!" I didn't think that was appropriate today, so I just decided to lay low. I met Brother Peter at lunch. Sorry, dinner. He's the monk who lives in an assisted living center but comes to the monastery for some events and services. The monks told me he was quite the talker, so I tried to steer clear of him. I was warned if he said, "Come spend some time with me," that meant I could be in for a few hours of conversation. I got sucked right into the reading room where we sat facing each other after lunch. Brother Peter is probably approaching 80, but he looks like he's in his early 60s. That's the theme with the monks here. They have a real youthfulness to them. As I get older, that's the one thing I want to hold on to. Youth. I recognize we can't trick time, but if we act young, think young, and play young, it can have an effect on how we deal with aging. It slows it down. "Ah, Jesse, I've heard a lot about you. We haven't gotten the chance to acquaint. Good to meet you, Brother Pete. It's interesting that a fellow with your background would be interested in our life. Well, I thought that, what are some of your goals? What draws you to the monastic life? When I was deciding if this life was for me, it was a different time, a much different time. Things were different back then. But you know what doesn't change, Jesse? The heart. It's the heart that doesn't change, but times change. Yes, they do. But the heart remains the same if we allow it to. If you ask me, I'd say he's still got his wits about him. Well, you see, I said, let me tell you a little bit about the monastery. Thanks. I think I have to. It's important that we acquaint in the event you decide to make this a career path. Career path? Pull up a chair. Come spend some time with me. Fortunately, we got interrupted just as those words came out of his mouth. A car was stuck in the snow and they needed an extra body to push it forward. I ran to my room, grabbed the coat, and bundled up. When I got out there, Lenny the intern was already behind the car pushing with no gloves or jacket. He looked at me with a, you live with a Navy SEAL and you had to go get a jacket on type of look. I think this asshole is intentionally trying to make me look bad, like we're in some kind of private intern competition or something and he's the only one playing. I swear, I'm trying to move past these negative thoughts and embrace Lenny for who he is. But I'm not even an intern. After we freed the car from the snowbank, I got pulled into the kitchen. Brother Gregory told me I was in charge of cleaning the dishes. All 300 of them from the retreat. The monks cleared out and left me with the plates, pots, and utensils. It was like I was the rookie on a sports team who was in charge of the laundry after practice. Can't wait to tell Sarah. Sarah. What did you do at the monastery, honey? Me. Dishes. Dog distractor. Oh, and I walked up and down the hill for hours. And while I was scrubbing a pot for the second time because it didn't pass Brother Gregory's inspection, I'm not even joking when I say I scrubbed it like a champ the first time, I overheard someone say, plenty have missed heaven by 18 inches, the distance between the head and the heart. I like that. So I treated every plate like it was a push-up, every pot like a pull-up, and every utensil like a sit-up. I was trying to bang them out as fast as I could, harder, faster. I was crushing those dishes. And when I finally finished, Brother Gregory told me it was officially my job to do the dishes for the rest of my stay. Brother Christopher led the retreat in the afternoon. We were in the church and he started with 20 minutes of silent meditation for the group. I find it's easier to meditate with a room full of people. I'm not sure why. And then Brother Christopher talked about the pressure we put on ourselves to succeed. We spend so much time worrying about things that may never happen, he said. And then he shifted his discussion to suffering, and that really got my attention. He said adversity is the great activator of spiritual awakenings. Suffering is the great accelerator to going inward. In the presence of dying, we discover our deepest life. Death, sickness, and loss pull us into a new moment and new way of thinking. When you deal with tragedy and it doesn't rob you of joy and peace, it's a great gift for others. I have to say, for someone who doesn't go deep, that's some deep shit. I've learned a lot about myself when I suffer, but my kind of suffering doesn't compare to what Brother Christopher was talking about. My suffering has always been self-inflicted through endurance races. In 2006, I entered the USA National Ultramarathon Championship. I adjusted my goal from winning the race to just completing the 100 miles in less than 24 hours. I raised money during my training and received over $1 million in donations, which only increased the pressure to finish. I gave myself 90 days to train, and I train like a machine. I always tell people that when you have a big goal, the work necessary to accomplish it has to become an obsession. It has to become a part of your daily lifestyle and remain that way for the duration of the goal. With that mindset, I trained twice a day, every day. It was an obsession. At night, I did research, reading articles and watching videos about achieving goals. Most of what I found had the same five themes. 1. Have a specific date for your goal. 2. Have an accountability partner. 3. Put the goal in writing. 4. Have a detailed plan to accomplishing your goal. 5. Execute your plan. The research helped me maintain my obsession, but all of that knowledge went out of the window at mile 75. My ankles were swollen the size of grapefruits. There were 6 toenails floating around my socks, and blisters appeared on my feet that looked like the purple grapes you can find at Whole Foods in the produce section. In that moment, I could have had my goal tattooed to my forehead, and it wouldn't have helped me. Fuck those goals, blogs, and self-help videos. They weren't going to run the last 25 miles. As I tried to keep running on the 1.1-mile dirt loop in Grapevine, Texas, I was struggling. But the short loop provided an opportunity for me to see the other runners during the race. And one of those runners competing was Pam Reed, a legend in the world of ultra running. She's famous for not only completing the Badwater race, the hardest race in the world, but winning it. As Pam passed me, we started to chat. Well, as much as one can chat while running their 76th mile. "I'm not feeling it today," she said. "This is my last lap. I'm going home." "No," I explained to Pam, I was running for charity and needed her help. I knew she could provide a wealth of information when the shit hit the fan. And truth be told, the shit was already flying around. I was in trouble. But I knew she'd seen it all. I needed her with me for the balance of the race to coach me through the pain. Thankfully, she agreed with a smile. "Just keep moving," she said. "Block it out of your mind. It's not going to kill you. Keep moving forward. Don't stop." I listened to her. I kept moving, one leg at a time, loop after loop. "The pain will last a week," Pam told me, "but you'll have the memory forever." At mile 84, she saw the self-doubt creeping back into my bones. My legs were like jello, and I truly wasn't sure if I could finish. I wanted to quit. She looked me in the eye as I was about to utter the words, "I don't know if I can make it." "No matter what," she said, "keep advancing." I crossed the finish line 22 hours and 30 minutes after the race started. It landed me in a wheelchair for 3 days, but I finished. I'd have never made it without Pam's advice, guidance, and support along the way. And that experience of suffering has helped me in so many other facets of my life. The memory has helped me cross many other finish lines. And I know that isn't the kind of suffering Brother Christopher was talking about. But what he said makes a lot of sense to me. I get it. Suffering can give us power. Day 6. Mr. Sarah Blakely. When it is obvious that the goals cannot be reached, don't adjust the goals. Adjust the action steps. Confucius. When you're alone for an extended period of time, all the concerns around work, schedule, and people you're pissed off at go away. And the important things rise to the front of your mind. "I really miss my kids. And of course I miss my wife. Just thinking about her reminds me of a few nights before I left." I headed over to a restaurant called 10 Degrees South with my friend and trainer, Mark. We were meeting Sarah there. The three of us planned to have a nice dinner while my kids were with my parents. We loved the restaurant. The food and decor are South African, which make it a fun and tasty place to go. And it's not far from our house. It's in Buckhead, just off of Roswell Road. When Mark and I walked in, we saw Justin. He and his wife own the place. Justin is an ex-professional soccer player who's got gorilla strength. And when he saw us, he ran over to pull me into his clutches. He squeezed me like my son Laser squeezes the toothpaste. There's nothing gentle about it. My guess is he's broken numerous ribs with that hugging technique. After our gorilla greeting, He walked us through the bungalow-inspired dining room over to the indoor patio. We sat down and waited for our waiter. And then I felt it. You know that feeling when you can just tell someone is looking at you? Yeah, that feeling. I had it. Eyes were on me like a heat-seeking missile. I looked up from the menu and scanned the dining room. There she was, a woman, perhaps a recent college grad, was laser-focused on me. She had wavy blonde hair, a pair of slender tan legs, and piercing blue eyes, staring. I quickly turned away, trying to play it off like I was looking for Justin or something. I looked over at Mark to see if he saw what I saw, but he was reading his menu. He was in his own little world. I kicked him under the table. "Mark," I said like a ventriloquist, "table 12. You think I know the table numbers? Whatever you do, don't look now. But over there," I said, "I think she's checking me out." "Who? Where?" I gave him the slightest nod with my head and guided him to the location with my eyes. Mark turned his chair around like he was positioning himself to see a performance of Hamilton. He definitely would fail as a private investigator. So blatant. And then he quickly turned back around when he got caught in the act. And this young lady kept her eyes on me the entire time. She wouldn't quit. "Did someone clone Kate Upton?" Mark said. "Holy shiznit." And then he whipped back around to make sure she was still looking. "Oh, yeah, she was." "She's checking you out, man," he said. "Dang." We were both baffled. Every time I looked up, she was still staring. This woman was like the antithesis of Medusa. Instead of turning people to stone, she could turn them into jello. Her stare went on for an hour. Okay, fine. I lied, but it was like 3 very, very, very long minutes. I must say, it felt good to be checked out by such an attractive female. I guess that's what it feels like to be swiped right in public. And when you're 48 years old, you gotta take what you can get. It was a nice ego boost. Harmless, but nice. And then she stood up and started walking toward our table. Her eyes were still laser focused, but now, accompanied by a huge, friendly Georgian smile. "This is bananas," I thought to myself. "What is she doing? What if she propositions me? What if Sarah walks in when I'm just chatting her up? Should I not talk to her? But isn't that rude?" She got closer and closer until she was standing right next to our table. Mark grabbed his water and quickly filled his mouth with it. "Excuse me," the young lady said. "I'm so sorry to interrupt, but can I ask you a question?" "Sure. I mean, sure." And then she paused for a moment. Are you married to Sarah Blakely?" "What?" Mark's water squirted out the sides of his mouth, and then he covered it with a napkin. Yeah, I said. "I am." "Oh, my God," she said. "I love her. I love what she does. She's such an inspiration. Oh, my God. I can't believe it. I can't believe you're Sarah Blakely's husband." "Yep, that's me." I thanked her for the kind words about my wife and told her that Sarah would have loved meeting her. She gushed a few more times before telling us that she had a run to meet her friends at some club called Sanctuary. She didn't even drop an invite. So rude. And then just like that, she was gone. Mark busted out laughing. "Fuck off," I said. The reality is, I'm very comfortable having a wife who's in the public eye. I could see how that could generate a lot of insecurity, but I take a lot of pride in being Sarah's biggest fan and cheerleader. Sure, there are times when it feels weird to sit at a dinner event where everyone wants to talk to Sarah way more than me, but it's fun to watch her star shine bright. That's what teamwork is all about. A big part of marriage is sharing in each other's successes, and I picked a great teammate. About 10 minutes later, Sarah walked through the door. I immediately told her about what had happened with the woman checking me out. She thought it was hysterical. And then our waiter stopped by to fill Sarah's water and told us about the specials. I love the food there, but I always consider it a cheat day. Sarah, on the other hand, thinks it's her healthy meal of the week. There have been many nights when I've seen her take down an entire box of Cheez-Its for dinner. She defines healthy as the plate having something green on it, like a sauce. When we were ready, Sarah ordered sweet ground beef curry topped with savory custard. Mark went with the 18-ounce bone-in ribeye, and I got butternut squash ravioli. As we waited for our food to be delivered, we talked about the topic on all of our minds. What was I going to do at a monastery? The three of us kept chatting until our food came. After we finished up, the waiter stopped by and offered some dessert. Justin's mom makes the desserts. They're called Thy Delights, and everything she makes is fantastic. We've never had a bad one. They're insanely good. The waiter asked Mark and me if we wanted anything, but we passed because we were planning to get a run-in later. I love the fruitcake, Sarah said with a smile. You're splurging, I said. I love it. Splurging? What are you talking about? That thing is going to have like 18,000 calories. 18,000 calories of fun, she said. Plus it has fruit in it, silly. It's healthy. God, I love my wife. I've learned so much from being around Sarah. That's another reason I miss her so much. She makes me better at everything. I feel like we're Karl Malone and John Stockton to each other. They were two skilled professional basketball players who made each other's game better. They played knowing each other's strengths and weaknesses and used it to their advantage. Sometimes I'm the point guard giving her an assist, and other times she's passing the ball to me down low so I can score. And sometimes with Thelma and Louise. Except we don't drive off of cliffs. But one of the things I love most about Sarah is her story and determination. Growing up, Sarah always wanted to be a lawyer, but she failed the LSATs twice. So instead of heading to law school after college, she decided to go to Disney World and try out to be Goofy. Of course she did. When she arrived, she was too short for the job. Minimum height is 5'8", and Sarah is 5'6". So they asked her to be a chipmunk instead. After a short stint at Disney, Sarah accepted a job with an office supply company called Denka and sold fax machines door to door for 7 years. One night before heading out for a party, she didn't like the way her own butt looked in white pants. She took a pair of scissors and cut off the feet of her pantyhose to avoid panty lines and have a smoother look under her clothes. Voila! Her invention and big idea was born. Still, having a big idea and turning it into a big reality isn't nearly the same thing. Here's where having experience can be a dream crusher. People have great ideas all the time, but they have just enough experience and have seen just enough failure to start to believe their chances of failing are too high. Sarah didn't know enough to think her chances of succeeding were low. Besides, failure was never a big thing for her. At the dinner table growing up, Sarah's father had a weekly ritual where he would ask her what she failed at that week. Maybe she had tried out for the school play, cheerleading, or a sports team. When she'd tell her dad how poorly it went, he would give her a high five. Whether she had succeeded or failed wasn't important. All that mattered was that she tried. That ritual changed Sarah's definition of failure. And failure became tied to not trying rather than the outcome. Over the course of the next 2 years selling fax machines, Sarah worked on developing her new idea after work, at night, and on the weekends. She took $5,000 she had set aside in savings to start the company. Since she had never taken a business class, she operated on instinct and gut. Instead of using her entire budget on legal fees to patent her product, Sarah bought a book on patents and wrote her own patent. She used bold colors in her packaging to make her products pop off the shelves. She spent 12 hours a day in department stores promoting her products for 2 straight years. It worked. The name Spanx came to Sarah while sitting in traffic in Atlanta. She knew that Kodak and Coca-Cola were two of the most recognized brands in the world, and that both names shared a strong K sound. She figured it must be good luck. She changed the KS to an X at the last minute because she heard that made-up words are easier to trademark than real words. When she launched her product, she began cold calling buyers in department store chains and got nowhere. She eventually got a meeting at Neiman Marcus in Dallas, but her sales pitch wasn't going so well. So Sarah called an audible and asked the buyer to follow her into the bathroom. This was a first for the buyer, but she was a good sport. Sarah put the footless pantyhose on in the bathroom and did her own before and after. The buyer said, "I get it. I'll try them in 7 stores. Today, Spanx has expanded way beyond just the shapewear that made them famous. They now have a cult following for their leggings, activewear, swimwear, bras, apparel, and her latest invention, arm tights. Sarah somehow just knows what customers want. It's fun to watch. She's an inventor at heart and holds several patents. But what she's most proud of is Spanx's greater mission of elevating women. Regardless, what I miss most about her is her unconditional love for her family, friends, and children. I went to check out the library this afternoon, and as I headed back to my room, I had to pass the kitchen to get there. And I spotted a jar filled with chocolate Clif bars. Josh the cook must have picked them up today. I used some bionic counting skills and immediately realized there were 11 bars. One for each monk, Lenny the intern, and me. I was famished. The fruit and soup diet had me craving these bars. Maybe the monks don't even know about them. Maybe Josh just put them out. Maybe monks don't even like Clif bars. All kinds of thoughts were flying into my head. And honestly, my hand went into the jar to grab one. Just one. But I sinned. I took all 11 bars back to my room and ate 3 before heading out. 3 p.m. Simple manual labor helps keep your mind clear, they say. And they're right. It does. I don't mind doing the work. It's just, I don't know. I'm having a hard time articulating my feelings. This afternoon, I scrubbed the church floors with a single scrub brush, along with Lenny the intern, on our hands and knees. And those floors were D-I-R-T-Y. There's nothing like monk dirt with all the work boots clomping around, all the people from the retreat, and the incense burning twice a day. I tried talking to Lenny to plot out a strategy for the floor, but he didn't say a word. How do people do that? Just not respond. Even when I'm in a disagreement with someone, even if I'm pissed, I respond. I say something. But talking to Lenny is like speaking Braille. Lenny, you want to start at the back and I'll start at the front? Nothing. As I started to clean, I seriously wondered why I came up to the monastery in the first place. Sure, I'm learning, but time is going by so slowly. I have to start listening to my wife. Just like my mom, she's virtually always right, which makes sense because Sarah's a mom too. She told me I just jump into things without thinking. And my mom used to say, be happy with what you have. I should listen to both of them. But instead, Billy the Bully was in attack mode. I mean, maybe I should have just stayed with my mom for a couple of weeks instead. I thought I was going to a monastery like the ones in Tibet. Instead, I got dog whispers in jeans and sweatshirts and scrub brushes. I kept grinding the bristles of the brush to the floor, hard. If I was going to be cleaning the floor, I at least wanted to do it well. There was a point when I was scrubbing that I looked over at Lenny, who was scrubbing like his life depended on it, and said to myself, if he says one word to me, I'm going to make him eat the brush. Not very monkish, but I was annoyed. I don't know why I get myself into these types of situations. I moved a Navy SEAL into my house, for heaven's sake. I want to live in a monastery filled with German shepherds. What's next? Alligator wrestling? A nudist colony in Antarctica? Dancing with the stars? Why do I keep looking for something I don't have? I think it's because I don't want to miss out on life. I mean, we only get one shot at it. So why not try to create as many memories as possible? I rolled over so I was sitting on my butt and looked up at the iconic portraits on the wall. Moses looked like you see him in most paintings, old, with a long white beard and holding two tablets with the Ten Commandments. He seemed to be looking back at me. "What's the matter with you?" Moses said. "Did you come all this way for nothing?" In my ear, he talked like Jackie Mason. "I made a mistake. I shouldn't have come." "A mistake? So that's the lesson you're going home with? Never go to a monastery?"
Something like that.
"Don't be a putz," Moses said. "The lesson is in your hand."
"There's nothing in my hand but this stupid brush."
"Exactly." While I was looking at the brush, the realization hit me like a Jackie Chan kung fu kick to the side of my head. The fact that I wasn't being tested by the monks was a test in itself. This wasn't supposed to be some magical spiritual journey. I wasn't supposed to levitate or reach enlightenment. I was supposed to scrub the floor and wash the dishes. I was supposed to learn by being a part of the community and by doing what they do. Billy the Bully faded away. It was in that moment I shifted gears and understood that sometimes we're just supposed to experience things, to allow them to happen naturally and be present for the moment. Stop worrying about things like whether my son scores at his soccer game, and just appreciate the fact he's healthy enough to be in the game. Floor scrubbing took 3 hours, and I must say, it looked fantastic when we were finally done. Like the ice at Madison Square Garden right after the Zamboni finishes making its rounds between the first and second period. I'm proud of the job we did. I stood there for a moment admiring our work. It felt good. I felt good. Afterward, I took a walk and did some soul searching. I'm here for the experience, I told myself, and I have to remember that. I'll never get another opportunity to give myself an extended time out and live at a monastery. I reminded myself of the two types of moments, the ones we can't control and the ones we create, and started to celebrate the fact that I'm creating this memory. So I need to focus. I'm going to try to absorb everything I can from the monks by participating, observing, and really trying to get to know them. I'm going to try to be part of the community as much as I can. I'll try to have fun too. I need to be strategic about this. I'm going to try to find out everything I can about this place and somehow figure out how to stop the noise in my head. Just because I'm staying in one of the quietest places on earth doesn't mean the noise between the ears stops. It seems like mine never stops. The idea of going home early still has some oxygen. The internal enemy is alive. The bully in my head, he still whispers to me, "It's time to go." At the evening service, the Cliff Bars got their revenge. My stomach was like an overstuffed washing machine on full tilt. It was growling so loudly and I could feel everyone in the congregation looking at me. I should have known. A monastery is the wrong place to mess with karma. I'm sorry. 11 p.m. About 2 hours ago, I think it was 9 p.m., I went with Brother Stavros to clean the dog pens. Every night, he walks over to the training center to let the dogs run outside so he can clean. Tonight, he asked me to join him. It was freezing and pitch black out as we walked the 200 yards from our sleeping quarters. Stavros didn't bring a flashlight. He navigated the trail like it was the middle of a sunny day. No issues. Seal would love this guy. "I can clean the pens if you want to play with the dogs," I said. "Nah," he said. "You should get to enjoy the dogs. Connect with them.
great. I was instructed during my time as a distractor to always greet a dog in a non-threatening position, with your hands low to the ground, making a fist. So when one of the dogs came over to greet me, I did just that. Not only does that calm the dog, but there's less flesh on your knuckles in the event you get bitten. As soon as the dog reached me, she bypassed my fist and made a mad dash for my nuts. One of the side effects of being up here alone is it has made me super horny. I think the dogs are picking up on it because she stuck her nose in my groin and sniffed me like a security dog checking for bags of cocaine at the airport. Stavros pulled her back and instructed me to hand her a treat. I did. She gobbled it in one bite. Better a treat than my nuts. And then she took one last whiff of my nuts before Stavros put her back in the crate. I'd already had my fill of dogs this evening after the first one, but we stayed with them until about 10:15 p.m. and then headed back. When I got to our building, I saw Lenny's door slightly open and heard some chanting coming from his room. I tiptoed into my room and wedged a meditation chair under my door handle to create a homemade lock. I'm not going to let anyone get me up here. Day 7. I didn't learn this in college. An ounce of practice is worth more than tons of preaching. Mahatma Gandhi. I was talking to some of the monks today about happiness again, but they were really trying to get my perspective on it. They wanted to know what I thought. I said something like, I believe happiness is a totally pure emotion. They were curious what I meant, so I told them two stories. It was 1985, and I was on the couch of my living room hanging out with my friend Myron. He was part of my crew, a two-man breakdancing crew. We got together every weekend and performed our routine wherever we could. One day I said to him, let's go to Washington, D.C. and perform on the street. There's no way those kids are as good as us. And it was true. Kids in other parts of the country were at least 6 months behind people breaking in New York. This is where shit was invented. So there was no way they'd be better than us. By the time other kids saw stuff on MTV, we were already on to the next. The idea had come out of nowhere, but like most good ideas, those are the ones to jump on. So we convinced my older sister Jill, who had recently gotten her license, to drive us down there. All we had to do was offer to pay her for a ride and her silence. Under no circumstances could she tell Mom. She liked the plan. So the next morning at 7 a.m., we piled into her car and hit the road. Breakdancing had become my full-fledged passion by my sophomore year of high school. I used to record shows like Soul Train and movies like Flashdance and try to learn every move. I watched in slow motion on my VCR and practiced in front of a mirror. Even my parents supported it. How many parents would let their son empty out the garage and fill it with cardboard boxes, a boombox, and mirrors to practice breakdancing instead of putting their cars in there? My parents were cool with it, but I couldn't tell them we were on our way to D.C. While my sister drove, Myron and I strategized on how we'd perform our routine. We kept trying to perfect the plan and come up with other ideas to make our act even better. We also had to navigate. We had maps and my dad's road atlas to help figure out the best routes, but with each mile, doubt started to creep into our minds. What if nobody shows up? What if we suck? What if people laugh at us? And eventually, 6 hours later, we completed the 4-hour journey. We were nervous as hell, but it was too late to back out. We found a parking lot next to a bank in Georgetown and set up shop. We had a huge boombox and mixtapes that we recorded off the radio, commercial breaks and all. And then we hit play. We started doing our 3-minute routine. But like I said, we didn't think the plan out too much because once the first 3 minutes were up, we weren't sure what to do next. So I'd do my thing and point to Myron. Then he'd do his thing and point to me. And then I'd do my thing and point to him. You can tell where this is going. But then a crowd started to form as we danced. After 30 minutes or so, I took off my hat and passed it around. The money started to pile up. When we were done, we took a 10-minute break and then started up again. And eventually a new crowd would come and watch. We kept doing it all day. My sister just stayed there and watched. She was part of every crowd. Eventually, though, we got kicked out by the manager of the bank. He said we weren't allowed to be doing this in the parking lot. We collected $280 that day. And after we paid my sister her fee, gas money, and bought lunch, we were left with $82. It was almost all singles and change. We each earned $41. I gave Myron his cut, and he counted it out one by one. And once he was done, he came running over to me and gave me the biggest bear hug ever. "Jess, we are fucking rich," he yelled. It was the most amazing feeling ever. I'd gotten over my fear of performing in front of people. We were doing something that we loved, and we were rich. In 1985, $41 went a long way for a teenager. We couldn't stop smiling the entire drive home. It was pure bliss. And when we pulled into our driveway back on Long Island, I looked over at my sister and thanked her again. "How far do you think it is to drive to Texas?" I asked. The monks really liked that story, but then I told them this one. Fast forward 20-plus years. I was sitting by the pool at the Beverly Hills Hotel and the sun was shining. I had a free day and had just ordered a big lunch. My friend Orlando and I were making plans for the evening when my phone rang. It was my marquee jet partner. I picked up the call and he told me to sit down. I was already sitting in a lounge chair. "Warren Buffett's company wants to buy our company," he said. Our company literally had changed the aviation business. Over the last 9 years, we had identified a market of people who wanted to fly privately a few times a year, clients who had the ability to purchase 25 hours of flight time instead of chartering a plane, signing a 5-year contract, or actually owning their own jet. We had done $5 billion in sales, had hundreds of employees, and always dreamed of someday selling our company. "Okay, then," I said to my partner, "let's do it." We were selling our company to NetJets, part of Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. It was incredible. And then I got off the phone and looked at Orlando. I told him the news. He couldn't believe it. He was so excited for us. When I was done telling the monks the stories, I posed this question. If you asked 1,000 people what would make me happier, A, driving to D.C., breakdancing all day, and making $41, or B, selling a company to NetJets, Berkshire Hathaway, what would people choose? My guess is all 1,000 people would answer B, and they'd be wrong. That day with Myron was one of the happiest of my life, a real high. The obvious lesson is that money won't bring you happiness, but everyone already knows that. For me, it's more about happiness being a choice. I prefer to look at happiness as a lifestyle, not a goal. The monks liked that. They liked it a lot. But here's the rub. As much as I love the lifestyle that includes new challenges and adventures, if I keep seeking these out to acquire more happiness, is it problematic that the lifestyle I live on a daily basis, the one that exists right in front of me, still needs more feeding? Happiness should never be insatiable. So today marked my 1-week anniversary here, and what I've learned is, this isn't just a monastery. It's a freaking business school. I got a chance to speak with the 3 nuns. Man, these are smart nuns. They started a cheesecake business with $1,000 in savings. They went to 6 local restaurants in the beginning and asked them to carry their cheesecakes on a trial basis. Now they're world famous and bake 20,000 cakes a year. They make and sell them at their home and ship them all over the world. If you buy in person, the sales process works on the honor system. You walk in, Nobody's there. You take a cheesecake out of the fridge, put cash in an envelope, and slide it through a slot. As a serial entrepreneur, I love the way they bootstrap their business. The monks are amazing.